the troops home now. Bring the troops. Let me hear you scream. Let me hear you scream louder.
That was the Reverend Jesse Jackson leading protesters at an anti-war rally yesterday in Washington. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Tonight we talk about just war. The church has spent the better part of its history discussing this perennial problem in human civilization and human intercourse. War, big, small, long, protracted, short, and bitter. Human history is as much a history of warfare and bloodshed as it is anything else. So what has the church had to say? Has the church taken a position based upon the Bible that Christians ought to be pacifists and take no part in war and support no wars? Jesus, after all, was the Prince of Peace. Or has Scripture taught us a militarism, a kind of cleaned-up Christian jihad or holy war? What is just war? We'll talk about that tonight on Issues Etc. Dr. Daryl Charles will join us as our guest. You can join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Daryl Charles is Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University. He's author of the new book titled Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Dr. Charles, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Oh, it's a delight to be with you again, Ted.
Well, we could not have a conversation without beginning in our present situation in the present war in Iraq. Is it a just war?
Yes. You know, you can't avoid that question, can you? Particularly the last several days, the profile has risen somewhat. Let me just say, I guess in the way of preface, before I give my own take on that, that's probably the most asked question of me. You know, Daryl, aren't you serving as an apologist for current foreign policy of the administration? One would naturally assume that Iraq was instrumental in my decision to write, but that was really not the case. I've had a longstanding interest in basic issues of justice, I guess, which goes back to the early and mid-1990s when I was doing criminal justice research in Washington. I would say, honestly, the geopolitical development since 1990, that is from the end of the Cold War, and then the events of 9/11, certainly helped to crystallize my own thinking about war and the use of force. But let me just remind the readers, Todd, Iraq has come and gone twice, 1991, 2003. What crisis will be next? That is, what will guide democratically oriented nations or the U.S. as they or we encounter future episodes of either genocide or political oppression or egregious human rights violations? And I think the larger question, should social political evil be resisted when and when not? So there are basic questions, it seems to me, that confront us. By what measure, if we say we should? By what standard? If not, why not? Now to your question, because the people are certainly wanting to know where I come down the subject. I guess a little bit of history is important to review. And there is a history here. There was, as I noted, a 91 war, was there not, which, according to our military leaders, was not finished. If people will remember, I believe there was a split between Schwarzkopf and Powell in this regard. It was considered, however, that the war was not finished. And but the cause of which was accepted by virtually all people to be just back that time. People hopefully will remember that there were, I think, 17 UN violations of sanctions that the UN in the end did not enforce. The question obviously is raised, who shall enforce them? Or even more basically, should they be enforced? And, of course, that points to the integrity and the morality of the institution of the United Nations. But, you know, that's a topic for another evening. 17 UN violations, though, should they then be enforced? What happens if we don't? And on top of that, you have, of course, the 25-year history of Iraq, at least since Hussein, of egregious human rights violations that are really unparalleled in the Middle East. There may be more in Syria, of which we don't know. Iran has been up and down, but there is a 25-year history that many people haven't really taken into account. And I think probably most of our readers, and I think most Americans, would have forgotten, Todd, Israel's threat back 14 years ago. Does anybody recall the Scud missiles and the threat of biologic warfare? Does anybody remember what we were watching on our televisions then? And then in connection with Israel, I'm recalling, as we speak, the 1992 preemptive strike by Israel. Does anybody remember that? On the town of Osirik, which was outlying to the capital. Iraq was close to weapons of mass destruction potential at that time. And in the last few years, Iraqi scientists who have emigrated or escaped have confirmed that that, in fact, was the case. So I would say, in answer to your question, given the threat that Iraq posed in terms of destabilizing the region, plus in the Middle East, plus the oppressive nature of the regime with egregious human rights violations, plus the 17 UN sanctions which were not enforced, the question is, should they be enforced? If so, by whom and how and why? My answer would be yes, the cause was just. But let me end with this. Simply because of post-war difficulties, we do not simply then go back and say, well, the cause never was just. And my guess is the people that have been protesting this weekend are those who, Todd, in principle, that is ideologically, would never be for the use of force. That is, they would probably be against war and military conflict and the use of force in any in all situations. That would be my guess.
Well, that leads me to my second question. Mm-hmm. That has to do with the contention by some, and perhaps even many, inside and outside the pale of Christendom, who would say, look, Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and he and the Bible in general teach pacifism. How would you respond?
Oh, boy. How much time do you have?
Well,
there are many within
one?
Our own ranks, and of course, within the Christian community, in my view, there is much confusion. I have to say, this was one of the major factors that contributed to the writing of the book among religious. I'm of the conviction, particularly having done criminal justice research on Capitol Hill, that we need clarity in the church before we can go out and offer the world or culture sufficient clarity. But what about Jesus? Insinuated in your opening comments and questions were that Jesus' love ethic, based on a reading of the Sermon on the Mount, calls us to nonviolence and to turn the other cheek, doesn't it? I mean, this is a problematic text and one that works in our consciences. I'm thinking here of Matthew 5, 38 and 39, perhaps for people who have their New Testaments handy. But turning the other cheek and not resisting evil. Very often, the pacifist claim is rooted in that, obviously in Jesus' love ethic, in the Sermon on the Mount, but that seems to be the core of the religious pacifist claim that Jesus taught nonviolence and turning the other cheek. And chapter 5 of my book, which is titled Christian Ethics and the Use of Force, really deals with this question head on and may be the most important chapter in the book strategically given the confusion, at least as I see it, in the Christian community. Very often among Christians, Todd, there is a conflation of Old Testament and New Testament norms. But even worse than that, there is an antithesis or an opposition that is set up between the ethics of the Old and the ethics of the New Testament, as if the God of the Old had a different ethical standard than the God of the New. And Jesus mediates the New, so it's thought, through his love ethic. So I think we have to consider then how we go about interpreting the Sermon on the Mount. Is the sermon a prescription of policy for the state? Or, as is my case, or at least in my conviction, is it dealing with issues of the heart? I think Romans 12 and Romans 13 are brought then are germane to this particular discussion.
Well, with about 30 seconds here, just give us before we go to this break, and then we'll expand on the other side. give us a brief overview of the 12 and 13
period. Yes. Well, the end of Romans 12 is Paul's admonition to shun a retaliatory mode, do what's right, strive for peace, avoid a vengeful spirit. And then he cites the Pentateuch, doesn't he? Just as his mind saith the Lord, I will repay. So here at the end of 12, Paul proscribes taking justice into one hand, vigilante justice, perhaps we can call it. But then there's a shift, and perhaps we can deal with it after the break. 13 finds him then locating or prescribing justice in the hands, not of the individual, the private citizen, but in the hands of the magistrate.
Dr. Dale Charles is our guest. We're talking about Just War tonight on Issues, Etc. Join our conversation. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address for questions and comments as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. More on Just War with Daryl Charles after this. Pastor Chad Bird, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why you should consider scheduling a visit to their campus today.
The church is always in need of pastors to preach the gospel and to administer the sacraments. And so we love to have any men who are interested visit our campus, learn what goes on here, sit in on classes, get a feel for what it's like to attend the seminary. And to consider the ministry as a calling in order that God might be served in the preaching of His Word and the giving of His gifts.
To schedule an on-campus visit at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the Concordia Theological Seminary logo.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
How would you like to meet Issues, Etc. regular guests Wesley Smith, Beverly Yonke, Gene Edward Veith, James Lamb, Bob Weiss, David Menton, and Nathan Jastrom all in one day? Well, they'll be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and join us as we broadcast live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference November the 11th in St. Louis.
I'm Matthew Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief and Human Care, the Mercy Arm of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." In the Gulf Coast and around the globe, we bring Christ's touch of mercy to people in need. Learn more on the web at worldrelief.lcms.org. And to donate, call 1-888-930-4438.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Just War tonight, Just War in Christian Tradition with Dr. Daryl Charles. Well, Reformation Sunday this year, believe it or not, marks the 10th anniversary of the weekly syndicated edition of Issues, Etc. We want to celebrate this milestone with you. We're going to be having a 10th anniversary banquet on Saturday, November the 5th, on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. I'll be the MC at that banquet. Dr. Larry Rast, a regular guest, will be the keynote speaker. The cost is $50 per plate, and space is limited to only 200 attendees, so don't wait to respond. Reserve your spot for the Issues, Etc. 10th Anniversary Banquet by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Many of our regular guests will be there, 1-800-737-0172. They're looking forward to an opportunity, and I am as well, to meeting you there as well. For more information, check out the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Charles, we had to stop you between Romans 12 and 13. Romans 12, dealing with the individual not to seek justice at their own hands or to take the law into their own hands. What is the shift that Paul makes in Romans 13 then?
Yes, we go from a proscribing of vengeance or taking justice into one's hands privately. Recall the context of Romans 12. It's the thread that unites all the material in chapter 12 seems to be relationships. Relationships within the body of Christ and then a relationship to the world. And so Paul waxes very practical here. Within the Christian community, of course, it's important that they understand their giftings. That's what he develops in the earlier part of chapter 12, how they relate to one another, how they build up one another in the grace of God. But then there's an equal, perhaps greater difficulty, and that is developing responsible relationships with the world, particularly if the world is going to be persecuting us, insulting us because of the faith. And you definitely sense that in the background. Therefore, Paul reminds them, look, don't take vengeance into your own hands. Don't respond to insults by taking justice into your own, but rather give justice over to God when it comes to insult. When it is assault, though, it's a very different matter, and that's why the authorities, introduced with almost no introduction at all, are so important. The authorities, Paul argues, as any good Lutheran in your audience knows, have been ordained by God and have the function of preserving the moral social order. But not only that, Paul uses strikingly uncritical, scandalous language in describing the authorities. He describes them as deacons. Diakonos is used as a term several times. And then they're described, I think, in 13:6 as the liturgist, literally that which renders service. So the authorities, in a scandalous way, are described by Paul as the instrument being used by God then to deal with evil and to preserve the social and moral order. So the difference between the context in chapter 12 and chapter 13 is striking. And that's why the material in Matthew 5 is so important as a parallel text, because very often the pacifist will read the Sermon on the Mount as a tract or a treatise on state policy, when in fact the context there is relations and issues of the heart. Consider just the problem verses do not resist evil and turn the other cheek, Matthew 5:38 and 39. The context of those statements, it seems to me, clarifies for us in a very freeing way the meaning of the text. It concerns an attitude of, shall we say, giving and going beyond. And Jesus is illustrating in four ways. First of all, give an extra article of clothing when it's demanded, okay, shirt, robe, what have you, then carrying someone else's luggage an extra distance, and of course in Palestine that would have meant that of a soldier when you're conscripted. Third, loaning to one who asks if to borrow something, and then fourthly, turning the other cheek. These are all personal issues. They're not policy mandates. Clothing and personal lending have nothing to do with public policy or statecraft, and the slap on the cheek in the context has to do with personal abuse, insult, and not assault. So the introduction, I would argue, of an innocent third party then would fully alter the situation. Jesus is not suggesting that we turn someone else's cheek in the face of injustice. And when there's a third party involved, then it's the requirement out of love to protect that particular party. And I think that agrees with the picture, Todd, that we find in the New Testament. Neither John the Baptist nor Jesus nor the apostles ever called the soldiers away from their vocation. And I think that's the brute reality the pacifist is going to have to acknowledge. Recall the Baptist's encounter with the soldiers recorded in Luke 3. And, of course, soldiers and tax collectors are two categories of people that are looked down upon. What happens? He admonishes them in two directions. First of all, he says, be content with your wages, and then don't oppress anyone. This is in the context of preaching repentance. So I think that's significant. And Jesus and the apostles follow suit with John the Baptist. Centurions and soldiers, they're commended for their faith, but never once in the pages of the New Testament are they called away from their vocation. So that seems to suggest that it's the intention and the manner with which we fulfill our calling, but not the actual work itself, that would render us illegitimate.
So then, very briefly, if the Bible does not teach kind of a carte blanche pacifism, does it teach a carte blanche militarism, especially on the part of the state?
Well, clearly that's not the teaching of the New Testament, and hence the title of the book, which seeks to mediate that. I would argue in the book, and I think there's plenty of evidence in the historic Christian tradition that we have a judicious Christian discernment of moral norms in the middle. If an absolutist pacifism, which would say that force can never be used as a moral entity, is not taught by the New Testament. And here, I want to be perfectly clear. I think at the personal level, I come out of a Mennonite tradition, by the way. I was raised in an Anabaptist home, and I admire my father, and I admire my relatives for that. And so I very much admire people who, at the personal level, are pacifist. However, the New Testament does not teach pacifism as a policy of the state. So while I admire that, my father was a conscientious objector in World War II, and he served those years in a veterans hospital doing alternative service. So I would say the people who, out of conscience, personally are against, they would be legitimate, but that's not at all legitimate as a teaching for the state required by the New Testament. But on the other hand, in answer to your question, neither does it teach an unqualified, unbridled militarism, and that's part of the problem of the nation state today. And that's one of the, I think that there we have to be sensitized, and there I am appreciating the influence of the pacifist who sensitizes us to the violent tendency of human nature. But as one who worked in the criminal justice context, Todd, I would say we do not have two positions or two alternatives before us. Either acquiescing to crime, let's use criminal justice and crime in the domestic context. Our alternatives are not two, either acquiescing to crime on the one hand or police brutality on the other. Rather, justice requires that we work, let's say, that we roll our sleeves up and we get involved in the messy middle, discerning not only when force is applicable and necessary, but also to what extent. And the just war tradition guides us in the domestic as well as the international context, because it guides us according to principles such as just cause, right intention, proportionality, and so on.
Let's talk about those on the other side of the break. Folks, tomorrow marks 1 month after Hurricane Katrina, and much has happened since that first big hurricane hit. For more information on how you can help support the victims of Hurricanes Katrina, Rita, and other natural disasters, look for the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call LCMS World Relief toll-free and donate 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. It's a relief agency that is concerned about both body and soul. LCMS World Relief, 1-888-930-4438.
What we do in times like this is pay close attention and recognize in it God's alien work to drive us to Jesus.
Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, on what Christians should know during times of disaster.
We should rejoice over our relationship with Christ, over our relationship with our family. We should speak forgiveness to those whom we have sinned against and those who have sinned against us. We should be quick to think about eternal things and not the ridiculous things that ball us up and bog us down, which are necessary for life, but rejoice in the eternal verities which sustain us.
For more information about LCMS World Relief, go to the Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org, or call 314-996-1683, LCMS World Relief.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with Pastor Mark Schaefer. He's coordinator of continuing education and related events for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Mark, how can a layperson benefit from attending one of the fall retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary?
These retreats offer some specific training, like the one coming up September 30th and October 1st and 2nd is specifically geared for lay leaders of the congregation. people who are in the positions of president, vice president, elder, deacon, people who are in the position to, you know, be leaders in the congregation can learn about what their role is and how they can work with the pastor. Also, there in this particular treat, there's a review of Lutheran doctrine. Who are we as Lutherans? What's our teaching? What are our beliefs? Even talking about worship life of Lutherans. And so, and also there's a lot of opportunities to fellowship with other Lutheran Christians who are probably in the same boat, having some of the same struggles as leaders in the parish of how to deal with day-to-day running the congregation. So there's an opportunity to learn from the instructor and to learn from one another and to, you know, reemphasize what we are as Lutherans.
So do people who attend these fall retreats participate in the worship life of Concordia Theological Seminary?
Oh, yes. Every day there is chapel, and that is part of the schedule. We allow for the all the participants to go to chapel and to worship with the seminarians. And also, you know, they can oftentimes, if they're on, there's meals involved, they eat in the same cafeteria as the seminarians do. And so, yes, there's opportunity to interact with the seminarians themselves.
Finally, Mark, talk about the commitment of Concordia Theological Seminary to having an educated laity.
Yes, we're trying to offer these retreats and to encourage. We're hoping to get more people involved with these retreats. It's so important that you know, the church, we have faithful pastors, but we also have faithful laypersons. The church can't exist without people, and the more that our lay people understand their role and how they fit in the church, you know, I think it's good for the church's mission, it's good for the church's service, it's good for the worship life of the church, too.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, or our website, issuesetc.org.
Peace train sounding louder.
We're talking about just war tonight on Issues, Etc. Dr. Daryl Charles is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Religion and Ethics at Union University, and he's author of a new book titled Between Pacifism and Jihad, Just War and Christian Tradition. Next week on the program, we're going to discuss cults and new religions. Dr. Ron Rhodes of Reasoning from the Scriptures will be our guest. Madonna and Elizabeth Taylor, they embrace Kabbalah. Tina Turner, Herbie Hancock, they like Buddhism. Michael Jackson and Prince, Jehovah's Witnesses. What separates a cult from Orthodox Christianity? We'll talk about it next week on Issues, Etc. with Ron Rhodes. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing for the rest of October, visit our website, issuesetc.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. Who really wrote the Book of Mormon? It is a historical account of the true origins of this book that Mormons count as holy and from heaven. Where did it really come from? It's in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. You can order Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The book is $16.99 plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon is our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. Dr. Daryl Charles is our guest as we talk about just war. Dr. Charles, before the break, you gave us a hint at some of the criteria that have been used by the church in making that determination of just or unjust cause, just or unjust war, and you mentioned a few, but let's deal with the bare bones just war criteria, if we could. Where do we begin?
Well, first of all, we have to begin with the five core criteria: just cause, right intent, proper authority that are the focus of the jus ad bellum, or literally the justice in going to war umbrella, and then the two primary jus in bello, that is justice in carrying out war in the midst of war, that those two criteria are discrimination or non-combatant immunity and proportionality. Perhaps a word or two about each. What are those norms that help determine the relative justness or rightness of a cause? In the history of the Christian moral tradition, those two groups of criteria serve as our guidelines, whether to go to war, the jus ad bellum, and how to conduct it, the jus in bello.
So how would you, in a sentence or two, describe the criteria of just cause?
Mm-hmm. Just cause, and well, a nation or people group must be able to identify an injury or injustice that's been inflicted. So, for example, when a nation invades or annexes its own or another nation or people group or territory, then the most basic human rights to sovereignty are violated. And in that case, military intervention is just in restoring those inalienable rights. So just cause wrestles with an appropriate response where gross injustice and moral culpability are established. According to Hugo Grotius, who's really considered the father of international law, sufficient justification of war also arises, and I think, Todd, this is significant, from humanitarian abuses. That is when another state, and I'm quoting him here, inflicts upon a subject such treatment as no one is warranted in inflicting. A question I have for not only our listeners, but which I would raise before my students. Where were we in the mid to late 90s when Rwanda was about ready to rupture? By the best estimates, 800,000 to 850,000 people were slaughtered. Now, there is a background. I'm not expecting necessarily that most Americans are aware of that. Not all of us are that interested in African foreign policy. But where were we? How about Bosnia, Herzegovina, Kosovo? How about Pol Pot in Southeast Asia in the 70s? Let me ask this way. Let's say there's a pending crisis, a genocide that's about ready to erupt. Do we, as a nation, does any nation in the West, but do we in the U.S., do we have a responsibility, as far as it is within us, to respond or to prevent that? Just cause, the just cause criterion in the just war tradition suggests that, yes, so far as it is within us, so far as it is within a people, so far as it is within a party, that injustice needs to be prevented. And sometimes that might be preemptive in nature, though that's going to require political prudence for application.
Now, I take it that right intent is not the intent of any individual who might go to war, but intent in terms of the proper authority mm-hmm. that would declare and wage war. How is that described?
Yes, precisely. And for that reason, proper authority, I think, needs to be stated in order to qualify, yet the third that you mentioned, right intention. For me, it's instructive, Todd, that for Aquinas, this was the most important of the three jus ad bellum criteria, proper authority. And perhaps we can understand it when we consider his day. War, for Aquinas, can only be waged by sovereign authorities. And perhaps we can try to identify, in a day when private wars or piracy or vandalism were being justified, Thomas' emphasis on order and proper authority was not misplaced. Once private warfare becomes normative, then all matters degenerate into revenge, don't they? And the magistrate, he argued, represents the people and thus is responsible for protecting the common weal against anarchy and tyranny. I mean, the principle is abiding for us. It's not just a medieval notion. Public goods require public authority to act on behalf of the community. And that's the burden, it seems to me, that's the burden of politics, rightly construed. So as it applies then to right intention, unjust war is perhaps best illustrated by what does not constitute right intention. Those sort of scenarios might include a sovereign's, our national pride or our reputation, national aggrandizement, bloodthirst, territorial expansion, even crusading, that is trying to right wrongs that were past. So the war or a military intervention must have a greater good. It must have a greater good as the aim, a justly ordered peace. So an ultimate peace that is a greater good must be the aim to qualify as right intention. Of course, that presupposes a proper political and governmental authority.
And then those two that you mentioned at the end very briefly,
yes.
Discrimination, and I think you did it, was it proportionality?
Proportionality,
all
yes.
Right. What are those while you are at war?
Yes, discrimination, others might recognize this as non-combatant immunity. The same sort of moral reasoning, Todd, that informs us with the first three helps us in the conduct, our conducting of war. Ends and means are related. The most basic moral prohibition, even in war, is the taking of innocent life. And that's why terrorism, which I'm sure we'll be addressing in a little while, is so heinous. Guilt is predicated on intention, is it not? So the non-combatant, inclusive of civilian populations, wounded soldiers, prisoners, women, children, and other non-participating males, cannot be held guilty because of human dignity. Respect for life is not to be forgotten. And so the idea of discrimination is very, very important in the just war tradition. And then lastly, proportionality. Just war thinking distinguishes itself from, let's say, crusading or militarism by its commitment to limit war. So the same moral guidelines that permit the application of force with prudence also limit it. This is the moral stricture that often is ignored by either the jihadist or the secular militarist who's willing to enter into total war. Now, for the secularist, of course, there are no moral restrictions whatsoever. For the jihadist, one depends on divine command. Allah or God has ordered it. But force as an entity must be regulated according to the just war tradition, and the degree of force applied is not to be greater than that which is needed to render the enemy compliant.
Right, I do want to take up that subject of just war and terrorism a little bit later in our conversation. We're ready to take your phone calls on just war, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Sunday night, the 25th of September, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Up first from St. Louis, listening on KSIV, it's Floyd. Floyd, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I had a question coming from Anabaptist, pacifist background. I understand the thinking that your guest had on the verses he gave as a personal item in persons, but I was asked a question about another where Jesus asked told Peter to put his sword up when he cut the high priest's servant's ear off.
It's a very good question, Floyd. Thank you very much. And we will get Dr. Charles' answer to that particular incident in Scripture in the context of just war after this break. Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. They're not only an underwriter, they're a provider of many of our very, very best guests here on the program. Concordia Theological Seminary is hosting several great retreats this fall, a lay leaders retreat, a confirmation retreat, a catechism retreat, and a Luther hostel retreat. For more information on these retreats, visit our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155. They're equipping the priesthood of all believers, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. All right. When we come back, we'll get to Floyd's question. There in the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter draws his sword. He strikes. He cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest. And Jesus says, put your sword away. Those who draw it perish by it. How do we understand just war in the context of that passage? After this. Does the Book of Mormon tell the real story of the lost tribes of Israel emigrated to North America, or was the Book of Mormon copied by Joseph Smith from someone else's fiction? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is called Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, the Spalding Enigma. The book is $16.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find the Book of the Month there at our homepage, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, The Spalding Enigma, or visit our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Reformation Sunday of this year marks the 10th anniversary of the weekly syndicated edition of Issues Etc. We debuted with 5 affiliates. We currently have almost 100 affiliates, listeners on digital satellite radio, and a worldwide listening audience on the Internet. Thanks be to God and Jesus Christ, and thank you for listening and for your prayers and financial support. We're especially thankful for a small, loyal group of monthly supporters, our Issues Etc. Reformation Club. To find out the benefits of becoming an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, or reformer, premiums like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts, visit our website, issuesetc.org, and look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us reach our goal of 200 Reformation Club members by Reformation Sunday, October the 30th. issuesetc.org. Issues Etc., the radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. Talking Just War with Dr. Daryl Charles tonight on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour is coming to Wichita, Topeka, and Kansas City early October. We'll be broadcasting live from 3 to 6 in the afternoon at Grace Lutheran Church in McPherson, Kansas on Tuesday, October the 4th, St. John's Lutheran Church in Topeka, Kansas on Wednesday, October the 5th, and live from Mount Calvary Lutheran Church in Excelsior Springs, Missouri, on Thursday, October the 6th. Everyone is invited to attend this live broadcast all 3 days and the free potluck that follows after every show. Feel free to come and go as you please. You don't have to come and stay for the whole thing. You can come when it's convenient and leave when it's convenient. For more information on the Issues Etc. Reformation Tour coming to Wichita, Topeka, and Kansas City, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. Charles, before the break, Floyd was on the line. He asked about the account in the Garden of Gethsemane, where after Peter has struck the high priest's servant, drawing blood, Jesus says, put your sword away. Those who draw it perish by it.
Well, if we interpret that as a flat, absolute statement, then no one in government would be able to implement criminal justice. Jesus' rebuke is personal, it seems to me, not an injunction on statecraft. Otherwise, the same Jesus would have rebuked the centurion when he came. I mean, the centurion, Jesus was not naive to the fact that the centurion had authority and would have used authority and certainly would have used the sword. Let's get back to the context of the use of the sword in the New Testament. It seems it occurs in two context. One, we already noted in Romans 12, the implication is that we do not, here Peter would be a good example, we do not take justice into our own hands. Rather, the sword or justice is sanctioned, how? In the hands of the magistrate. 13. So in 12, it's proscribed, it's prevented, it's illegitimate. In 13, it is prescribed. Why is it prescribed? Why is the sword placed in the hand of the magistrate to exercise wrath on the evildoer? That is to say, to keep evil in check and to preserve the social moral order in society. Now, the same Jesus who also rebuked Peter about his use of the sword for personal reasons also said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. So he's acknowledging that there are domains in which we need to offer respect and reverence. I'm struck by the language of respect and reverence that occurs not only in Romans 13, but also a parallel passage, 1 Peter 2. for the authorities. Respect, not worship, mind you, but respect. 1 Peter 2:17, it seems to me, is worth citing there, where the writer says, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. It's interesting that he doesn't say, fear the emperor and just honor God, but presupposed is the fear of God, which will, and I think this is borne out by the context of 1 Peter 2 and 3, respect, that is working, trusting God to use Christian faith operative in the social institutions, not to fall into compromise or idolatry, but simply acknowledging the fact that honoring the institutions opens doors and allows the gospel to go forward. I don't think that's compromise, but neither is that idolatry on the other side.
Another listener joins us from Sunnyvale, California, listening on KFAX. JC, welcome to Issues, Etc. 1-800-730-2727. Hi, JC.
Hello, how you doing? I've always been intrigued by this one verse, and it's considered one of the hard sayings of Jesus, where he says, if you don't have a coat, if you don't have a sword, sell your coat or something like that and buy one. And then one of the disciples says, here's two swords, and Jesus says, it is enough. What does that mean? Does he condone the purchase of the weaponry or whatever I'm just overall just wondering what did Jesus mean when he says it is enough?
Thanks, JC. I appreciate it. I was thinking of those two passages as well, Dr. Charles. About a minute here for a response.
Where are they located, Todd?
I don't know. JC's got his Bible open to him. Haven't found him yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I would probably want to understand them against the backdrop of what's going on there, and also in the wider against the wider backdrop of New Testament teaching on the sword, and against the Jesus' broader teaching as well too. Jesus speaks of violence when he speaks about discipleship and the division of the family, does he not? I think in Matthew 17 or 19, we have one of the do not suppose statements. The first one was don't suppose that I've, in Matthew 5, don't suppose that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to affirm them. And then the second one, don't suppose that I've come to bring peace. I've not come to bring peace, but I've come to bring a sword. And then he describes the division of our allegiances, and he speaks in terms of familial obligations and what have you. Perhaps that's relevant. You know, we can't interpret that literally as being militaristic and aggressive, but I do think the imagery there is noteworthy, and that is that he comes to pierce. He does not come just to bring peace in the sense that the world understands it, but rather relationships will be divided. Husband and wife, in some cases, fathers and sons will be divided. Mothers, brothers will be divided. And so the very closest, most meaningful relationships in our lives will be tested by the truths, by the truth claims of the gospel. And I think that's important to remember. At least as we look at the language of violence and the imagery of the sword that Jesus uses, there very often it's the cutting or the division, the cutting between relationships and the testing of the commitment of our discipleship.
1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. From Kansas City, listening on KCCV, Barbara, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, let me state that I'm so concerned about war as a Christian citizen in this day and age because of what it does to the church in many areas of the world where the United States foreign policy is active. Specifically, I would like to ask Dr. Charles how he could apply any of these principles for just war in the Zionist war that took place in Palestine in 1947 and 48. That has so damaged the church ever since and has never been a conclusive war, and it's just an endless agony in that part of the world.
Barbara, thank you. Dr. Charles, you got 1 minute for that toughie.
Well, I think our caller would need to qualify the Zionist war that has done great damage. Perhaps she may be assuming more than most of the listeners might be at this point.
Dr. Charles, with only 1 minute here, when we look at just war in the light of terrorism, and we could talk about this in the next hour, Can we distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, between those who are going to be the targets of violence in war?
Well, that's a difficult one. Certainly the pacifist is going to raise that as a problem that can't be set aside. My own reading of that is simply that when there is a decision through political prudence to go to war and then to conduct war, there are going to be casualties. But it's understood, however, that those who would be targeted are not going to be civilians. Now there are always going to be casualties involved in any sort of military context. So, you know, the issue does not reduce, it seemed to me, to will there be any innocent life that will be sacrificed, but rather how do we go about sparing as many as possible. Now, in the second war with Iraq, that was virtually impossible, simply because of the fact that munitions dumps were underneath hospitals and mosques and what have you. But
folks, we're coming to you live this Sunday night, September the 25th. We will continue to respond to your phone calls and your email tonight for Dr. Daryl Charles as we talk with him about just war. 1-800-730-2727. That's our call-in number. We will be giving away Dr. Daryl Charles' book, Between Pacifism and Jihad, to the listeners with the best questions and the best comments for Dr. Charles in the next hour. 1-800-730-2727. Call during this break. It's a good time to call and line up. 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, you can only listen to the next hour's conversation as we continue on the web. So go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click Listen Online. You'll hear the next hour with Dr. Daryl Charles, and we'll continue to take your phone calls, 1-800-730-2727. This is the biggest question we have, because war is the perennial reality of human history. How does the church look at, in the basis of God's word, what Christians have been given to do as citizens, what the government and the magistrate has been given to do as our representatives, and continue to ask in each and every case? And believe me, the question will always be asked and always need an answer. When is this just? When is the cause right? And how should we go to war? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.